Chapter 13.
Caroline's parents never seemed to remember anything about their time in the snow globe. At least they never said anything about it, and Caroline never mentioned it to them. Sometimes she wondered whether they had ever noticed that they'd lost 2 days in the real world, and came to the eventual conclusion that they had not. Then again, there are some people who keep track of every day and every hour, and there are people who don't, and Caroline's parents were solidly in the second camp. Caroline had placed the marbles beneath her pillow before she went to sleep that first night home in her own room once more. She went back to bed, after she saw the other mother's hand, although there was not much time left for sleeping, and she rested her head back on that pillow. Something scrunched gently as she did. She sat up and lifted the pillow. The fragments of the glass marbles that she saw looked like the remains of eggshells one finds beneath trees in springtime, like empty, broken robin's eggs, or even more delicate, wren's eggs, perhaps. Whatever had been inside the glass spheres had gone. Caroline thought of the three children waving goodbye to her in the moonlight, waving before they crossed that silver stream. She gathered up the eggshell-thin fragments with care, and placed them in a small blue box which had once held a bracelet that her grandmother had given her when she was a little girl. The bracelet was long lost, but the box remained. Miss Spink and Miss Forcible came back from visiting Miss Spink's niece, and Caroline went down to their flat for tea. It was a Monday. On Wednesday, Caroline would go back to school. A whole new school year would begin. Miss Forcible insisted on reading Caroline's tea leaves.
"Well, looks like everything's mostly shipshape and Bristol fashion, lovey," said Miss Forcible.
"Sorry," said Caroline.
"Everything is coming up roses," said Miss Forcible. "Well, almost everything. I'm not sure what that is."
She pointed to a clump of tea leaves sticking to the side of the cup. Miss Spink tutted and reached for the cup.
"Honestly, Miriam, give it over here, let me see."
She blinked through her thick spectacles.
"Oh, dear. No, I have no idea what that signifies. It looks almost like a hand."
Caroline looked. The clump of leaves did look a little like a hand, reaching for something. Hamish, the Scotty dog, was hiding under Miss Forcible's chair, and he wouldn't come out.
"I think he was in some sort of fight," said Miss Spink. "He has a deep gash in his side, poor dear. We'll take him to the vet later this afternoon. I wish I knew what could have done it."
Something, Caroline knew, would have to be done.
That final week of the holidays, the weather was magnificent, as if the summer itself were trying to make up for the miserable weather they'd been having by giving them some bright and glorious days before it ended.
The crazy old man upstairs called down to Caroline when he saw her coming out of Miss Spink and Miss Forcible's flat.
"Hey! Hi! You! Caroline!"
he shouted over the railing.
"It's Caroline," she said. "How are the mice?"
"Something has frightened them,"
said the old man, scratching his moustache.
"I think maybe there is a weasel in the house. Something is about. I heard it in the night. In my country, we would have put down a trap for it. Maybe put down a little meat or hamburger. And when the creature comes to feast, then, bam, it would be caught and never bother us more. The mice are so scared they will not even pick up their little musical instruments."
"I don't think it wants meat," said Caroline. She put her hand up and touched the black key that hung about her neck. Then she went inside. She bathed herself and kept the key around her neck the whole time she was in the bath. She never took it off anymore. Something scratched at her bedroom window after she went to bed. Caroline was almost asleep, but she slipped out of her bed and pulled open the curtains. A white hand with crimson fingernails leapt from the window ledge onto a drainpipe and was immediately out of sight. There were deep gouges in the glass on the other side of the window. Caroline slept uneasily that night, waking from time to time to plot and plan and ponder, then falling back into sleep, never quite certain where her pondering ended and the dream began. One ear always open for the sound of something scratching at her window pane or at her bedroom door. In the morning, Coraline said to her mother, "I'm going to have a picnic with my dolls today. Can I borrow a sheet? An old one, one you don't need any longer. As a tablecloth." "I don't think we have one of those," said her mother. She opened the kitchen drawer that held the napkins and the tablecloths, and she prodded about in it. "Hold on. Will this do?" It was a folded-up, disposable paper tablecloth covered with red flowers, left over from some picnic they'd been on several years before. "That's perfect," said Coraline. "I didn't think you played with your dolls any more," said Mrs. Jones. "I don't," admitted Coraline. "Their protective coloration." "Well, be back in time for lunch," said her mother. "Have a good time." Coraline filled a cardboard box with dolls and with several plastic dolls' teacups. She filled a jug with water. Then she went outside. She walked down to the road, just as if she were going to the shops. Before she reached the supermarket, she cut across a fence into some wasteland and along an old drive. Then she crawled under a hedge. She had to go under the hedge in two journeys in order not to spill the water from the jug. It was a long, roundabout journey, but at the end of it, Coraline was satisfied that she had not been followed. She came out behind the dilapidated old tennis court. She crossed over it to the meadow where the long grass swayed. She found the planks on the edge of the meadow. They were astonishingly heavy, almost too heavy for a girl to lift, even using all her strength. But she managed. She didn't have any choice. She pulled the planks out of the way, one by one, grunting and sweating with the effort, revealing a deep, round, brick-lined hole in the ground. It smelled of damp and the dark. The bricks were greenish and slippery. She spread out the tablecloth and laid it, carefully, over the top of the well. She put a plastic doll's cup every foot or so at the edge of the well, and she weighed each cup down with water from the jug. She put a doll in the grass beside each cup, making it look as much like a doll's tea party as she could. Then she retraced her steps back under the hedge, along the dusty yellow drive, around the back of the shops, back to her house. She reached up and took the key from around her neck. She dangled it from the string as if the key were just something she liked to play with. Then she knocked on the door of Miss Spink and Miss Forcible's flat. Miss Spink opened the door. "Hello, dear," she said. "I don't want to come in," said Coraline. "I just wanted to find out how Hamish was doing." Miss Spink sighed. "The vet says that Hamish is a brave little soldier," she said. "Luckily, the cat doesn't seem to be infected. We cannot imagine what could have done it. The vet says some animal, he thinks, but has no idea what. Mr. Bobo says he thinks it might have been a weasel."
"Mr. Bobo?
The man in the top flat. Mr. Bobo. Fine old circus family, I believe. Romanian, or Slovenian, or Livonian, or one of those countries. Bless me, I can never remember them any more." It had never occurred to Coraline that the crazy old man upstairs actually had a name, she realized. If she'd known his name were Mr. Bobo, she would have said it every chance she got. How often do you get to say a name like Mr. Bobo aloud?
"Oh," said Coraline, aloud, to Miss Spink. "Mr. Bobo. Right.
Well," she said a little louder, "I'm going to go and play with my dolls now over by the old tennis courts round the back."
"That's nice, dear," said Miss Spink, and then she added confidentially, "Make sure you keep an eye out for the old well. Mr. Lovett, who was here before your time, said that he thought it might go down for half a mile or more."
Coraline hoped that the hand had not heard this last, and she changed the subject.
"This key,"
said Coraline loudly. "Oh, it's just some old key from our house. It's part of my game. That's why I'm carrying it around with me on this piece of string. Well, goodbye now."
"What an extraordinary child," said Miss Spink to herself as she closed the door.
Coraline ambled toward the old tennis courts, dangling and swinging the black key on its piece of string as she walked. Several times she thought she saw something the colour of bone in the undergrowth. It was keeping pace with her, about 30 feet away. She tried to whistle, but nothing happened. So she sang out loud instead, a song her father had made up for her when she was a little baby, and which had always made her laugh. It went, "Oh, my twitchy-witchy girl, I think you are so nice. I give you bowls of porridge and I give you bowls of ice cream. I give you lots of kisses and I give you lots of hugs. But I never give you sandwiches with bugs in." That was what she sang as she sauntered through the woods, and her voice hardly trembled at all. The doll's tea party was where she had left it. She was relieved that it was not a windy day, for everything was still in its place. Every water-filled plastic cup weighed down the paper tablecloth as it was meant to. She breathed a sigh of relief. Now was the hardest part.
"Hello, dolls," she said brightly. "It's tea time."
She walked close to the paper tablecloth.
"I brought the lucky key," she told the dolls, "to make sure we have a good picnic."
And then, as carefully as she could, she leaned over and gently placed the key on the tablecloth. She was still holding onto the string. She held her breath, hoping that the cups of water at the edges of the well would weigh the cloth down, letting it take the weight of the key without collapsing into the well. The key sat in the middle of the paper picnic cloth. Coraline let go of the string and took a step back. Now it was all up to the hand. She turned to her dolls.
"Who would like a piece of cherry cake?" she asked. "Jemima? Pinky? Primrose?"
And she served each doll a slice of invisible cake on an invisible plate, chattering happily as she did so. From the corner of her eye, she saw something bone-white scamper from one tree trunk to another, closer and closer. She forced herself not to look at it.
"Jemima," said Coraline, "what a bad girl you are. You've dropped your cake. Now I'll have to go over and get you a whole new slice."
And she walked around the tea party until she was on the other side of it to the hand. She pretended to clean up spilled cake and to get Jemima another piece. And then, in a skittering, chittering rush, it came, the hand running high on its fingers, scrabbled through the tall grass and up onto a tree stump. It stood there for a moment like a crab tasting the air, and then it made one triumphant nail-clacking leap onto the center of the paper tablecloth. Time slowed for Coraline. The white fingers closed around the black key. And then the weight and the momentum of the hand sent the plastic doll's cups flying, and the paper tablecloth and the key and the other mother's right hand went tumbling down into the darkness of the well. Coraline counted slowly under her breath. She got up to 40 before she heard a muffled splash coming from a long way below. Someone had once told her that if you look up at the sky from the bottom of a mine shaft, even in the brightest daylight, you see a night sky and stars. Coraline wondered if the hand could see stars from where it was. She hauled the heavy planks back onto the well, covering it as carefully as she could. She didn't want anything to fall in. She didn't want anything ever to get out. Then she put her dolls and the cups back in the cardboard box she'd carried them out in. Something caught her eye while she was doing this, and she straightened up in time to see the black cat stalking toward her, its tail held high and curling at the tip like a question mark. It was the first time she had seen the cat in just over a week, since they had returned together from the other mother's place. The cat walked over to her and jumped up onto the planks that covered the well. Then, slowly, it winked one eye at her. It sprang down into the long grass in front of her and rolled over onto its back, wiggling about ecstatically. Coraline scratched and tickled the soft fur on its belly, and the cat purred contentedly. When it had had enough, it rolled over onto its front once more and walked back toward the tennis courts like a tiny patch of midnight in the midday sun. Coraline went back to the house. Mr. Bobo was waiting for her in the driveway. He clapped her on the shoulder.
"The mice tell me that all is good," he said. "They say that you are our savior, Caroline."
"It's Coraline, Mr. Bobo," said Coraline. "Not Caroline, Coraline."
"Coraline,"
said Mr. Bobo, repeating her name to himself with wonderment and respect.
"Very good. Coraline. The mice say that I must tell you that as soon as they are ready to perform in public, you will come up to watch them as the first audience of all. They will play Tumpty Umpty and Toodle Oodle, and they will dance and do a thousand tricks. That is what they say."
"I would like that very much," said Coraline. "When they're ready." She knocked at Miss Spink and Miss Forcible's door. Miss Spink let her in, and Coraline went into their parlour. She put her box of dolls down on the floor. Then she put her hand into her pocket and pulled out the stone with the hole in it. "Here you go," she said. "I don't need it any more. I'm very grateful. I think it may have saved my life, and saved some other people's death." She gave them both tight hugs, although her arms barely stretched around Miss Spink, and Miss Forcible smelled like the raw garlic she had been cutting. Then Coraline picked up her box of dolls and went out.
"What an extraordinary child," said Miss Spink.
No one had hugged her like that since she had retired from the theatre. That night, Coraline lay in bed, all bathed, teeth cleaned, with her eyes open, staring up at the ceiling. It was warm enough that, now the hand was gone, she'd opened her bedroom window wide. She'd insisted to her father that the curtains not be entirely closed. Her new school clothes were laid out carefully on her chair for her to put on when she woke. Normally, on the night before the first day of term, Coraline was apprehensive and nervous. But, she realized, there was nothing left about school that could scare her any more. She fancied she could hear sweet music on the night air, the kind of music that can only be played on the tiniest silver trombones and trumpets and bassoons, on piccolos and tubas so delicate and small that their keys could only be pressed by the tiny pink fingers of white mice. Coraline imagined that she was back again in her dream, with the two girls and the boy, under the oak tree in the meadow, and she smiled. As the first stars came out, Coraline finally allowed herself to drift into sleep, while the gentle upstairs music of the mouse circus spilled out onto the warm evening air, telling the world that the summer was almost done.